Hello, this is Jennifer Joyner from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. So sit back and enjoy. Chapter 16, The Man Who Found the Hunley, Charleston, South Carolina. For more than a century, when ships headed out of Charleston Harbor, they passed over the heads of 9 dead men. The men lay restlessly tossing and shifting on the bottom of the sea in the confinement of their metal coffin, the H.L. Hunley, a Confederate submarine. They waited for the world of the living to resurrect their remains and honor their bravery. One man has played a significant role in the drama of the Hunley. He is Dr. E. Lee Spence. Spence began his underwater history and treasure hunting in 1960 when he was only 12. "It's a wonder I didn't kill myself during those early years," he admits with a boyish grin. He made his own diving gear from a fire extinguisher canister. By the standards of what he would use in later years, his equipment was primitive, but his research was professional and his luck monumental. The tall blonde diver and marine archaeologist went on to discover some of the world's most famous shipwrecks and write articles for prestigious journals describing his discoveries and the artifacts brought up. His finds of hitherto undiscovered and amazingly intact shipwrecks attracted the praise and interest of numerous individuals and institutions, including Captain Jacques Cousteau, director of the Institut Oceanographique, National Geographic Magazine, the National Park Service, and the director of the Underwater Exploration Program of the Smithsonian. Since his early teens, the young diver had a dream. Most divers hoped to find a Spanish galleon laden with gold, but Lee Spence's dream of a lifetime was to find the H.L. Hunley. Discovering history is what excited him most, and somewhere at the bottom of Charleston Harbor lay the Confederate submarine long recognized as the greatest naval innovation in over 2,000 years. Lee Spence had listened with fascination as men speculated about its possible location. He had researched accounts of the trial runs of the Hunley, of its mechanical workings, and of its crew. As a professional diver, he well knew the perils of underwater exploration. This is the story Dr. E. Lee Spence reconstructs of the Hunley mission. During the most dangerous months of the Civil War, while the city of Charleston was shelled almost daily by the Union blockade, the Hunley made ready for action. It was just after twilight on the evening of February 17, 1864, that 9 men, dressed in new Confederate uniforms, 2 of them sporting the gold braid of officers, walked eagerly to Breach Inlet near Charleston. They hurried so as not to be caught and stranded by the ebbing tide. As the last of the 9-man crew squeezed into place along the submarine's heavy crankshaft, the hatches were dogged shut. Sweat began to break out upon the men's brows, and they resisted the first stirrings of claustrophobia, then panic. They bravely managed to thrust both emotions aside. Gears screeched with a metallic sound as the men forced the crank around and around until they were just beyond the harbor. Here and there in the metal interior of the sub, their eyes watched drops of moisture slide down the walls. Of course, what the bold and colorful George Trenholm, chief of 60 Confederate blockade runners, hoped, along with General Beauregard, was that a submarine attack would not only sink one of the powerful Union blockaders, gathered like hawks in the harbor, but disrupt the entire Federal blockade of Charleston. On that crisp, cold February night in 1864, 3 gleaming lanterns in a row pointed seaward from the Confederate Battery Marshal at the eastern end of Sullivan's Island. Meantime, just offshore, on the ebbing tide, Lieutenant Dixon and his crew edged slowly through the mirror-like sea. The long, lethal body of the submarine headed west toward the Union blockade, its destination, the channel off Morris Island. Here, the pride of the Union Navy, the new warship Housatonic, lay at anchor. Unsuspected by its crew, the ship was in mortal danger. Ballasted to float with her hatch just above the water, the Hunley made a difficult target at night, but at this moment every man was tense. They were passing a Union picket boat. Would they be seen? Lieutenant Dixon held his breath. A spy had warned the Union Navy that the Confederates might launch some unknown underwater weapon, but their pickets did not seem to notice the submarine, and so its black, cigar-like body wallowed furtively past them in the dark. Peering out the tiny deadlight in the submarine's forward hatch, Dixon tried not to think about some of the disastrous earlier experiments with his craft. He had heard stories of the contorted faces of the dead crew, described by men who had had the sad task of dismembering and pulling the stiffened bodies from the salvaged submarine. He went over in his mind whether those sinkings were just bad luck or errors that could have been avoided. Fingering the lucky gold coin from his fiancée in his pocket, he repeated to himself that the heavily dented coin had once saved his life from a bullet. Would it bring him luck again? Dixon had not accepted this command, believing that he and his men would face certain death. Granted, the tiny sub was not easy to maneuver, but he and his crew had taken the boat out nightly on drills, and they had always returned. All that was different tonight was that this was no practice. Now they were approaching their target. The submarine was barely big enough to accommodate 9 men, who were able to turn the crankshaft in such a confined space only by contorting their bodies and turning the crank over and over in unison. Lieutenant Dixon scanned the faces of his crew and, seeing their exhaustion, called for a few minutes' rest from the effort. The candle in the submarine flickered erratically, showing a lack of oxygen, and some of the men were beginning to grow nauseated. Dixon immediately raised the breathing tubes so that a slight breeze struck the men's cheeks, freshening the air. This lifted their spirits, and their mission now seemed possible. They were not far from the Housatonic, where they planned to embed their torpedo, placing it below the waterline in the hull of the huge Union blockader. Then they would back off a suitable distance and detonate the charge. Their torpedo contained 90 pounds of gunpowder and was fastened to the end of a 20-foot spar on the bow of their craft. The barb of the torpedo would hold it mortally embedded in the hull of the Housatonic while they backed away. At a safe distance, they would pull the lanyard and detonate the torpedo. But what was a safe distance, thought Lieutenant Dixon, and as a precaution, he unbolted the hatches and threw them open. They would at least provide an escape route if the sub sank. The faces of the men on the submarine were grim and detached as they approached the Union blockader, and Lieutenant Dixon was finally able to see the large bold letters forming the name Housatonic on her side. Then, looming up before his tiny sub, was the immense, heavily armed ship, her decks filled with patrolling sailors. Suddenly, one of the lookouts halted and stared straight down at the submarine. The lookout had almost decided that what he saw was a floating log when he realized the log had changed course and was moving diagonally across the flow of water. It was the secret weapon the blockaders had been told to watch for. He shouted the alarm, raised his musket, and fired several times in the direction of the submarine, but he was too late. There was a roar like a clap of thunder and a bright flash that set the sky on fire. On the other vessels, men saw the sailors run to abandon ship as the Housatonic, reeling from the torpedo's blow, began to sink. Within 3 minutes, she was beneath the water. And what happened to the Hunley? It is believed that the submarine survived the initial blast, but, finding herself in the midst of the rescue operations, unwisely chose to submerge. Whether a deadlight or seam blew out is unknown, but water pouring into the submarine blocked the men's escape. Divers came out and dragged around the wrecked blockader, but failed ever to find the submarine. Although E. Lee Spence had spent many hours searching for the Hunley with sophisticated electronic equipment, that is not what he was doing in November of 1970. He was on a trip to fish for sea bass. Traps had been set off the Miss Inna, captained by Joe Porcel, and 2 of the traps had hung up off the stern. Spence, diving to retrieve them, followed the fish traps down to the bottom and peered through the gloom. It was only previous research he had done that caused him to notice the strange appearance of a dark, rusted ledge upon which one of the traps was caught. Landing on top of a narrow, cylindrical object that formed a long ledge in the sand, he broke off a slender yellow sea whip that protruded from it, and carefully rubbed the spot on which it had grown. When he withdrew his finger, he saw the greasy black smudge made from years of rust. Then his eyes traced the outline of the almost cylindrical shape that tapered off into the sand. At the end nearest him, he noticed the raised marks of hand-hammered rivets. He thought of all the days spent in libraries, studying notes, diagrams, maps, and charts, reading through endless rolls of microfilm, and knew he had found the Hunley. "The dream was beneath my fingers. I wanted to stay down there and savor it forever," says Ely Spence. "But on the other hand, I wanted to share it immediately." Filled with excitement and a certain lack of caution, Spence shot up to the surface, shouting to the men in the boat, "I found it! I found the Hunley!" It is not so surprising that a man of Dr. Spence's experience should make this dramatic discovery and produce the necessary maps to confirm it. What is amazing is that for 105 years, divers searched in vain for the wreck of the world's first submarine to sink a warship. In fact, after the event in 1864, it would be 50 years before any other submarine would duplicate this feat. In 1970, Spence became the first person to report the location of this historic weapon of warfare to the state of South Carolina. Later, at the official request of the Hunley Commission, Spence donated his rights to the submarine to the state of South Carolina. The value of the Hunley is estimated at over $25 million. Someday, South Carolinian Dr. Ely Spence will receive formal recognition for his discovery in both the annals of naval warfare and the history of his native state. After its restoration, the H.L. Hunley will be on display at the Charleston Museum of History, 360 Meeting Street. Telephone 843-722-2996. Chapter 17. The Mystery at Fort Sumter, Charleston, South Carolina. No one knew better than Major Robert Anderson that he was sitting on a shell that could explode at any moment. On December 20, 1860, the Secessionist Convention in Charleston notified Washington that the state had seceded from the Union. As far as the state authorities were concerned, South Carolina was now an independent nation. The continued presence of a Union fort in Charleston Harbor inflamed Confederates, who had sent repeated requests to Washington, through Southern sympathizers, to negotiate a peaceful withdrawal of Fort Sumter's Union troops. When these requests were ignored, the Confederate reaction was predictable: force. Trapped here with no promise of military reinforcements to come to his aid, Major Anderson was as unhappy as the Southerners who surrounded him. He, too, had sent countless messages to Washington, appeals to President Lincoln warning him of the potentially explosive situation. The messages asking Lincoln to recognize the seriousness of the situation and act were ignored by the new and inexperienced president. Major Anderson requested that the president either supply Fort Sumter with reinforcements or grant him permission to withdraw. Lincoln did neither. The fort did not have enough men to repulse the strong Confederate attack that Anderson knew would come, and he would be forced to defend the flimsy wooden barracks of an unfinished fort against a heavy assault. Even Fort Sumter's own powder magazine was a danger, apt to explode under enemy bombardment. By early April, more requests reached Anderson from the Confederates, asking him to withdraw peacefully to avoid bloodshed. Daily, the major hoped to receive orders from Washington to leave the fort, but none arrived. In the late afternoon of April 11, 1860, Major Anderson sat at his desk writing another report. He knew now that the Confederates would probably launch their attack that night. He rose from his desk and asked his adjutant to summon Captain Foster. "See that the men sleep in the bomb shelters tonight. Have they made an area safe for the wounded?" "Yes, sir." "What about the ammunition?" "It's been distributed to the guns, sir." "Have the men enlarged the storage area?" "Captain Gustavus Fox is going to attempt to land with supplies." "Attempt, sir?" repeated the officer. Then he reddened. "Sorry, sir." "If he's got any chance to get through, it will be tonight," said Anderson, lips pressed tight and face drawn. "Yes, sir. We will watch for Officer Fox, sir, and we're doing everything possible to seal the rest of the fort. I have men filling sandbags and piling them up on the parapet. That may protect us against the rebel guns from Sullivan's Island." He gave the major a quick salute and hurried back to supervise the men, who resembled ants as they carried their bulky loads to and fro in the wan light of a new moon. They labored until 10 o'clock that night. Foster himself watched and listened for Naval Officer Gustavus Fox to approach the fort with tugboats bearing supplies for the Union troops. Just after midnight, the Confederates delivered a last ultimatum to Anderson. It was a promise not to fire if the Union troops would evacuate peacefully. Then they waited several hours for a reply. Finally, it came. Major Anderson said he would evacuate in about 3 days, but only if he didn't receive supplies and became hungry. This reply did not elicit a good response from General Beauregard. Without waiting for the 3 days to pass, or for the major to get hungry, the angry Confederates fired a shell to signal the beginning of the bombardment. Anderson, who had gone to bed, waked to a scene that might have been straight from his worst nightmare. A floating ironclad battery was anchored off Sullivan's Island, with the barrels of its guns firing at his left flank, and as he watched, Confederate soldiers streamed out of their boats to occupy every island surrounding Fort Sumter. The unfortunate Major Anderson had written increasingly blunt warnings to inform President Lincoln of the threat to the Union fort. He had waited for replies to them, but received none. Now the Confederates were attacking his men. His guns on Fort Sumter could blast the Confederates out of the water, and that was exactly what he wanted to do, but unless he heard from Lincoln, he had no authority even to defend himself. The major watched the battle in helpless frustration. 34 hours later, with the wooden barracks and the officers' quarters in flames, Anderson was forced to surrender. Miraculously, no one had been killed, but a strange incident took place. In surrendering, Anderson requested that when his garrison left the fort the following afternoon, he be allowed to give a 100-gun salute to his tattered Union flag before lowering it. The Confederates granted his request. When the 47th round of the salute was fired, the cartridge in Union Private Daniel Huff's gun exploded as he was driving it down the barrel. The explosion blew his right arm from his shoulder, mortally wounding him, and sparks touched off other cartridges that lay nearby. That same afternoon, while the evacuation was going on, Private Daniel Huff's own company buried him, presenting arms as the body was lowered into the soft, sandy soil of Fort Sumter. A naval chaplain from the city read a prayer. Next morning, just before finishing their last night's tour of duty inside the fort, 3 of the Union soldiers fashioned a wooden headboard for Huff's grave. More than a century later, in the late 1990s, Arnold Ashby, a visitor from Kentucky, was at the fort touring the museum when he thought he experienced the breath of another person upon the back of his neck. Moving slightly to one side, he glimpsed a puff of gray smoke in the air above him. He could have sworn that there was the acrid scent of gunpowder in the air. Turning, he was shocked to see what he took to be the blue-coated form of a soldier. For a matter of seconds, Ashby glimpsed a face with a mustache, beard, and a well-defined nose. These were his only impressions as the man melted into the crowd of tourists pressing to view the exhibits. Only the scent of gunpowder lingered, and Ashby found himself feeling sick. When had he last smelled gunpowder like that, he asked himself, and the answer was at a reenactment. After that first battle of the Civil War, a strange thing happened to the flag that had flown over the fort. To the immediate right of the center star, the flag faded and left a white spot. In that lighter area, the outline of a man's face became imprinted. The man was Private Daniel Huff. He was wearing a Union cap, and beneath it, his features were visible, closed eyes, mustache, nose, and beard. The flag is displayed in a glass case in the Fort Sumter Museum. Others, like this writer, believe that the image of Private Huff's face on the flag is most clearly visible in the third white stripe, just to the left of the black vertical line. Huff's ghost is said to still inhabit the fort, and his apparition is seen most often in mid-April. 4 years to the day after Anderson surrendered Fort Sumter, on April 14, 1865, he returned for a ceremony of celebration to mark the fort's return to Union hands. The ceremony was made more jubilant by receipt of the news that General Robert E. Lee had surrendered his army. the stroke of noon on April 14, 1865, General Robert Anderson raised his garrison flag over Fort Sumter again. President Lincoln did not attend the ceremony. He and his wife had a previous engagement at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. He would not appear at Fort Sumter or anywhere else ever again, for that night President Lincoln was assassinated. Tours going out to Fort Sumter leave the Charleston waterfront several times a day. For hours, phone 843-722-1690. Chapter 19. The Gray Ghost near Edisto, Ashpoo, South Carolina. There are still a few very old men who remember hearing the one-time slaves on Edisto Island talk of Civil War days. The slaves listened avidly to former soldiers who had served in the Federal ranks, and they heard the southern side from friends who were Confederate body servants. Some of the slaves continued to serve the young planters they had grown up with, who fought for the Confederacy, but by the 1930s only a handful of former slaves were left who recalled the stirring days when they heard the big guns shoot. For them, nothing would ever match the 1860s. Sometimes soldiers fought in the fields the slaves had just cultivated, skirmished along the very roads they had walked that day, or Yankee or rebel died a few feet from their cabins. Old William Rose, who lived down at Seaside on Edisto, was a mere youth during the war, but having had some schooling, he talked well. In later years, Rose could occasionally be persuaded to tell one of his stories about rebel times. Although he used modified Gullah, he was perfectly understandable, and his speech had the richness of Afro-English words mixed with a rhythmic flow of Gullah. One February day in the 1930s, a reporter named C.S. Murray was interviewing him for the Charleston News and Courier, when William Rose began to philosophize about bravery and warfare, both ancient and modern. "Men don't know what they fight for," Rose said. "They think they fight for some fine, shining thing, but who knows?" Then he began to talk of the effect war has on people, and he told a story. "The bravest thing I ever saw was at Ashpoo Junction on the Charleston and Savannah Railroad. Trainloads of Confederate troops passed through there on their way to the battlefields. It was nearing the end of the war. Grant was ready to smack Richmond, and Sherman was marching tromp, tromp, tromp across Georgia. I was just a young lad then, and I had to see and hear it all. One day the plantation overseer sent me to Ashpoo Junction to get the mail." The old man's eyes sparkled, and he was like a little boy again, reliving one of the most exciting moments of his life. "That afternoon, when I reached Ashpoo, the train was just rolling in. Smoke from the engine was in the air everywhere, and car after car was filled with Confederates. They come shouting in from Charleston, bound for the upcountry. Seemed like I got there just in time to see what was going on. I stood near the long trestle and watched the train rock by. One engine was in the front pulling, one was in the back pushing, pushing, pushing. The train was loaded down with soldiers. They thick as peas. They were riding all over the car roof. They shout and holler. I was much amazed to see such a lot of soldiers, all going down to die. And as they go across the trestle over the river, they start to sing. One pick a banjo, one play the fiddle. They sing and whoop, they laugh. Goodbye, they holler out to the people around the train. Goodbye. All of them are going down to die. And it seems to me that is the most wonderful sight I ever saw. All those soldiers laughing lightly, singing and shouting that way, and all of them going down to die. One soldier shouted, 'Well, boys, we're going to cut the Yankee throat. We're going to meet him, and he better tremble, 'cause we are on our way. Our gun is greased and our bayonet sharp. Boys, we are going to eat our dinner in hell tonight.' One gang riding on top of a car was playing cards. I saw him hold up a card, plain as day when the luck was right. They were going to face battle, and yet they played cards and sing and laugh like they were in their own house, all going down to die. The train pulled across a trestle. I stood up and watched the men until the last car pulled out of sight. The last thing I heard was the soldiers' songs, all going down to die. When I got home, I went to some of the old people. I said, 'How can a man act like that?' And they answered me, 'That ain't nothing. They used to it. but I still wonder and wonder to this day, how can those soldiers laugh and sing and talk about dinner and hell when they going down to die? Ashpu is still here between Jacksonboro and Green Pond, not far from Highway 17, says John Jeffries, who lives there. It's just a wide place in the road now. All we have is two filling stations and a manufacturing plant. Let me tell you an experience I had here. It was a cold February night in the 1960s when the dark came down fast and there was no moon. I had worked late at the plant and was walking home along Main Street, not far from the railroad tracks, when I began to hear a sound way off down the tracks, growing louder and louder. It was a long, plaintive train whistle, followed by the sound in the distance of men singing, but the voices were not clear enough for me to hear all the words well. I caught fragments of them, "Hurrah, hurrah," and "The Bonnie Blue Flag Forever," echoed through the stillness of the night. Now, I'm a Southerner, and I knew that tune, for it was one my mother had played many years ago on the piano, a Civil War song. I heard the long hiss from a steam locomotive, and, strangest of all, for maybe half a minute, the ring of men's laughter. Then all was quiet. Jeffrey said he stood there wondering. Where could the train be, and the men who had been singing? And where had that long, drawn-out, eerie whistle come from through the cold night air? As far as he could see, nothing was there now, just a railroad track in a little town, slam-dunk in the middle of nowhere. Puzzled, he shook his head. Was it the ghosts of long-dead Confederate troops going through Ashpu on their way north? Chapter 20. A Night to Remember. John Cross Tavern, Beaufort, South Carolina. The village of Beaufort was a buccaneer haven in 1718, and the John Cross Tavern a place for pirates to relax and brag about their prizes, stolen cargoes of tea, spices, silk, and rum. They were snug as could be, their ships anchored in some virtually hidden inlet among the 68 islands off the southern South Carolina coast. Now and then, in the tavern, one of the pirates snapped a bit off the stem of his clay pipe and, raising it to his lips, inhaled the tobacco deeply, then swigged from his bottle of rum as he sang a coarse song. Another, with a sweeping drunken toast to his lady, might overturn an oil lamp. Someone would grab for it wildly, replace it, and start a song. With a wink at the women they clasped, the men clanked their pewter mugs spiritedly on the bar to punctuate a phrase of the song. Scarves held back their headlocks, and many wore pistols under their belts or cutlasses at their sides. "You're pretty as I ever saw you, Anne," shouted tall, handsome Captain Sam Bellamy to Jack Rackham's companion, Anne Bonny. The jealous Rackham, his face flushing with anger, reached for his knife. "Sheath it, Jack," called out beautiful red-haired Anne Bonny, contemptuously, "or Sam will have your liver." Two or three of Rackham's crew closed in around him and dissuaded him from a fight that might have ended disastrously at the hands of a better man. Evening seldom went by without some near-violent incident or boisterous play. Anne Bonny sat in the tavern at one of the small tables near the wall and smiled as she, like the men, bit off the end of one of the clay pipes, a nod to sanitation. She provocatively returned Captain Bellamy's wink. "Back to the ship with you, my girl," shouted Rackham angrily. She paid no heed to him and began to walk toward Bellamy. As she passed, Captain Edward Lowe reached out and clasped her bare arm with his hand. "Get your dirty paw off me, Eddie," she cried, turning with sudden fury and knocking his hand away. "Watch yourself, Anne," warned Rackham. Edward Lowe had an explosive temper. He also had a cruel streak, and few of the pirates in the room wished to cross him. The angry curses of Lowe followed Anne and Rackham as she rejoined him, and the pair left the tavern. These were the days when you looked sharp if you put out to sea from Beaufort Harbor. Pirates might lurk behind any of the many islands, ready to pounce. In the days when former sea captain John Cross opened his tavern and lodging house, 2,000 buccaneers roamed the Atlantic coast. There was Captain Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard, Captain Sam Bellamy, well known around Provincetown, Massachusetts, who sailed the Whydah after the African city of that name, Captain Edward Lowe from London, whose ship was ironically dubbed the Happy Delivery, Captain Billy Lewis, who sailed the Morning Star and captured ships off the Carolina coast until 1726, And then there was Calico Jack Rackham and his beautiful red-haired sweetheart, Anne Bonny. Dangerous cutthroats and sea robbers, all, from New England, they sailed the length of the American coast and on to distant waters like the Red Sea, busy with commerce between Europe and Asia, coming home to sell their stolen cargo at Charleston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. In the 1700s, places along the coast like the John Cross Tavern were few and far between. There a respectable man could drink hot grog and find decent lodging, but he sometimes found himself mingling with the pirates who also patronized the tavern. John Wesley, a founder of the Methodist faith, found lodging at the John Cross Tavern August 3, 1736, on his way to England. Today, voices are raised and glasses ring at the tavern, just as they did almost 300 years ago. This early two-story building, strong because its walls are built of a mixture of lime and oyster shells, called Tabby, still stands on Beaufort's Bay Street. Both restaurant and tavern are now upstairs. Those who would stop for a meal must watch for the colorful picture of a pirate on the ground floor at the left side of the building. An arrow beside it indicates the outside stairs by which patrons mount to the second floor. When owner Harry Chiquitas restored the John Cross Tavern to its original use, he found four floors had been placed, one on top of the other, in the course of its history. The tavern room has the original molding, similar to some in Williamsburg, Virginia. For the past four decades, Citadel graduate Chiquitas had looked over the Beaufort River and the docks where barks and brigantines, with sails billowing in the breeze, once lay at anchor. Beaufort once vied with Charleston for the honor of being the most popular South Carolina port, as the town has a fine natural harbor. Unfortunately, however, it is indefensible. Some of the spirits of the tavern's early past are still here, says Chiquitas. I knew it the first week. Mother and I were cleaning, and she was in the other room. I heard her say, "All right now, come out and let me see you." I called to her, saying, "What's the matter, Mother?" "One of those chairs has started moving back and forth," she replied. "It must be the ghost, so I challenged it to show itself." There were two more strange incidents the first week Harry opened. I had a girl cleaning on the second floor, and she came tumbling down the stairs in a panic, crying, "Someone up there is calling my name." I said, "Oh, it's just the ghost. Don't worry. He's friendly." She calmed down. Another incident occurred regarding some heavy boxes we had moved in and arranged along the hall to unpack. When I looked for them and didn't see them at first, someone started laughing. And I said, "Are you laughing at me?" "No," he said. "Look, someone has moved all our packing boxes to the other side of the hall." But the most eerie happening was one night when I had stayed here all alone to clean the large room downstairs. It was late, and I swept and scrubbed and polished, humming as I worked. Little by little, I became aware of soft, rustling, persistent noises. I was sure I heard footsteps on the floor above. Then voices mingled with the sound of tussling, and I flew up the stairs. All along one wall, shadows were moving, the shadows of human beings. Amazed, I began to try the finger games I had done as a child to see if I could reproduce the shadows that looked like people, but none of my finger play changed one movement on that wall. The shadows continued to gesture and gyrate, moving independently of me. I have never discovered the cause. But the ghost is different. Its presence is often felt here near the entrance to the dining room. It is where a partition between two rooms was taken out to make a larger one. I have been told that in this case the person who lived in one of these rooms may return as a ghost, but not understand what has happened to the room he once had. Perhaps that is the case with the place near the entrance to the dining room. It is here that the spot of chillingly cold air is felt. Years ago, salesmen going to a town would live for a while in a lodging house like this while they did business locally. Sometimes they might stay several months, and occasionally they died of what we hope were natural causes in these rooms. Several present-day guests have mentioned feeling a chill in certain rooms. Others believe they have experienced a cold, sepulchral hand resting on their shoulder. I like to think that the touch is a concerned one from the spirit of John Wesley, returning to implore someone to repent. Or perhaps it is the hand of tavern keeper John Cross himself, calming a rowdy customer. Although some believe they have been seized by the vice-like fingers of pirate captain Edward Lowe trying to shanghai them out the back door to his ship. But what really happens late at night in this old building? Are shadow images of pirates with gross and terrifying faces moving across the wall of the tavern tonight? Do the spirits of Blackbeard, Edward Lowe, Billy Lewis, Anne Bonny, and Calico Jack Rackham ever return from the bad place? And does their return ever crisscross with that of present-day guests at night in the John Cross Tavern? The John Cross Tavern, located at 812 Bay Street, is open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Phone 843-524-3993. Chapter 21. The Admiral's Wife. Anchorage House, Beaufort, South Carolina. Everyone who has ever discovered this unique coastal town knows that at some point on the highway entering Beaufort, you've gone back in time. You've entered a world where one street after another is lined with magnificent Revolutionary and Civil War period homes. As if to confirm this, you will see an old cemetery in which lie citizens who have passed on before the rest of us. Those who defended this land from Indians, skirmished with pirates, battled the British, and reluctantly hosted the Union Army. Does a town like Beaufort have ghosts? Of course it does. In addition to the house called the Castle and the old John Cross Tavern, we must place another name on the list of local sites that have apparitions. The Anchorage has been known to be haunted for years, according to Frederick Kedge, former owner. This enormous white house, with its Corinthian columns, is one of the most impressive overlooking the bay. Mrs. Kedge and her late husband owned and operated it as a bed and breakfast. The lady describes herself as an agnostic, but says whatever inhabits that house is an entity that showed up the first Thanksgiving after we opened it. People would complain, saying, "Someone bumped me as I was coming down the stairs," or there were areas we walked through where we noticed a considerable chill. Of course, Mrs. Kedge began to search her mind for the possible presence of people who had lived here who might have had an attachment to the house. The first was William Elliott's family. Mr. Elliott built this house just before the Revolution. Then there was the pre-Civil War William Elliott III. A maverick, he opposed secession and resigned his seat in the South Carolina Senate rather than vote for nullification. On the other hand, he was violently pro-Southern and in favor of slavery, probably because he owned 12 plantations and could ill afford to lose his laborers. With these views, he managed to anger both his Southern and Northern friends. But Elliott remained a staunch Unionist until war broke out, and then, like Robert E. Lee, he went along with the state. During the occupation of Beaufort, his house was turned into a hospital, like many other homes in town. One of its claims to fame is that, in 1876, Wade Hampton, a former Confederate general who had actually freed his own slaves before the Civil War, made a speech to the citizens of Beaufort from the front porch during his campaign for governor. Thus far, we have several possible situations for ghostly activities, but Mrs. Kedge has long thought that, of those who have lived here, the ghost most likely to haunt the Anchorage is that of the Admiral's wife. In the early 1900s, retired naval officer Admiral Beardsley purchased the William Elliott House, and he and his wife spent $80,000 remodeling it. Of course, everyone knows how admirals are, and it is said that Mrs. Beardsley was also a person of strong opinions. In any case, she must have cared deeply about the admiral, for she kept his ashes on the mantel for many years after his demise. In time, the Anchorage became a guest house. When visitors asked where the entity was, Mrs. Kedge told them, "Anywhere it is damp and cold." It was most often sensed as coming from the lower level, an updraft of air that came blasting upstairs. Mrs. Kedge says, "We had the air conditioning system redone, but no sooner had we finished than in the lounge there were complaints that now the cold air was worse than ever. When there were large dinners served, the Anchorage would hire extra help." Mrs. Kedge usually hiring several Marines from nearby bases at Parris Island. They, too, became aware of the entity. According to a lady who worked at the Anchorage for many years, the basement is the place where things happen, and some servants are reluctant to go down there. The most startling experience was that of a Marine from the base. Working at the inn for the evening, this young man entered the cellar to bring up a famed Merlot for a banquet. When he reached for a bottle of it, he found himself at a standoff with a fierce-looking figure swathed in bandages who was holding an upraised sword. "The Marine fled up the stairs from the basement, screaming," says Mrs. Kedge. Others have been equally terrified. Whether they experienced an unexplained blast of cold air, met the ghost of the Admiral's wife, or saw apparitions from Civil War days when the Anchorage was a hospital, it is unknown. But it must take quite an awe-inspiring apparition to shake the nerves of a Marine. The Anchorage is not open to the public at this time. It is located at 1102 Bay Street. Chapter 22, The Hilton Head Spectre, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Old ruins and old legends live side by side beneath the moss-draped live oaks that grace Hilton Head Island. And if something supernatural happens here, visitors to this picturesque island should not find such an occurrence surprising. This is the story of a strange phenomenon out of the past being repeated in the present. Have you ever wondered what happens to old ghosts? I have often asked myself whether the apparitions people have seen that I wrote about in my earlier books still appear. A letter I received recently from a Hilton Head visitor may provide an answer. As background, let me summarize the story of Martin Baynard and Victoria Stoney from my book South Carolina Ghosts from the Coast to the Mountains. Marriages in the Old South were sometimes for love and sometimes arranged by the families because of large property holdings. Both seem to have been the case at Hilton Head when John and Elizabeth Stoney announced the engagement of their only daughter, Victoria Ann, to Martin Baynard. The wedding was to take place in August, some years before the Civil War. In the meantime, each afternoon the pair would ride in Martin's cabriolet down winding sandy roads lined with pines and scrub oaks. Occasionally they would stop if either saw something interesting. "Isn't that an old slave graveyard over there among the trees?" Victoria asked on one of these rides. When they got out and went over to look at a small mound of freshly dug earth, Victoria was touched. "It's the grave of a little girl," she said. "And here is her doll." She picked the doll up from the grave, studied it curiously, and put it back beside the small cup and spoon nearby. Then she lifted the cup. "Put that down," said Martin, more sharply than he had intended, for he was disturbed without knowing why. She replaced the cup on the grave. "The Gullahs have different beliefs from our own," he warned her. But who could have told them that danger lay not in some Gullah superstition, but rather in contagion from a deadly fever that would strike Victoria down? A few days later, the shining carriage which was to have carried the young pair away was draped not with celebratory white ribbons, but with the black ribbons of death. Much to everyone's astonishment, in the midst of his sweetheart's funeral, Martin's carriage dashed madly out of the cemetery. It was only a matter of hours before he himself died from the fever. On the very night of the day his body was placed in the family mausoleum, there were strange reports of his apparition driving the carriage. Some said they heard the thunder of horses' hoofs, while others felt a rush of cold air as the carriage sped past. A few were sure they had seen an impressive golden-black carriage racing beside the foaming surf or hurtling along down island roads in the moonlight. Viewers always mentioned the fluttering black ribbons streaming in the wind. But if you are really interested in whether there could be any truth to these old stories, look over my shoulder and share with me the following letter I received recently from a lady who vacations each August on Hilton Head. Then judge her experience for yourself. Here is what she says. "My husband mentioned, when he managed to contact you by phone, that I wanted to relate an incident that I experienced last summer at Hilton Head Island. It is now a year later, and after reading your book, South Carolina Ghosts, from the coast to the mountains for the first time, I was immediately struck by the similarity of a story of yours with my experience last summer. We have been staying at Hilton Head since the summer of 1984, and nothing like this has ever happened to me before. It was August of 1996. There was going to be a full moon on the last Wednesday night of the month, and I knew it would be lovely. Late the night of the 28th, it became cloudy, and I grew more disappointed by the moment as I sat alone, waiting to see the moon rise over the water. Everyone else had gone to bed, and I sat by myself on the upper deck of our villa. Suddenly, I had the bold idea of going down to the beach alone. The surf was unusually rough that night due to Hurricane Edward out at sea. I thought to myself that if I were out there on the beach, I could revel in the sight of that moon full above the water. I still had hopes that it would suddenly appear, and if it did, this would be a night to remember. High tide had occurred approximately at 9:05 p.m. I looked at my watch, and the time was now midnight. Should I go inside to find a flashlight? It seemed unimportant, so I started off without it. When I reached the end of the narrow wooden walkway and was about to step down into the sand, my peripheral vision caught an enormous speeding shadow at my right. My heart began to pound wildly. All was quiet save for the sound of the surf. Then I felt a sudden rush of wind strike my body, and the shadow rolled past. It seemed to touch and meet the fingers of foam at the edge of the surf. Up the beach it stopped. To my utter amazement, the tall, dark form of a man got out of the carriage and stood beside it, staring back in my direction. I cannot describe the energy that I felt emanating from him. I have never felt so afraid, so utterly vulnerable and alone. Turning around, I dashed recklessly back over the wooden walkway, through the grass, and up the steps of our villa, with no desire to look back. As I tried to unlock the patio door, my hands trembled, and my fingers moved awkwardly. Should I go out through the door upstairs and try to catch another glimpse of what I had just seen from the upper deck? Was it still there? I didn't have the courage to find out. I stood inside my bedroom with my back against the door, trying to catch my breath. Then I ran to the windows and doors, locking them hastily, turned off all the lights, and got into bed. I went over that scene in my mind, tossing sleeplessly until daybreak. Next morning I hurried out and searched for signs of a carriage or any marks whatsoever on the sand. I don't know just what I hoped to find, but whatever I had seen left no traces. I am not convinced that my family really believed me when I related my experience. But on the other hand, there is no doubt at all in my mind about what I had seen that night. I found it strange and foreboding. This summer we all returned to Hilton Head for our annual family visit together the last week of August. Nothing out of the ordinary took place, but I did discover your book in Author's Store at the Village at Wexford. There it lay in the store window, and my daughter and I both saw it at the same moment. I bought it on that day, which was Thursday the 28th, the anniversary of the date I had seen the carriage the year before. Perhaps the death of Martin Baynard's fiancée occurred on the same date in August that the dark carriage came hurtling toward me beside the water. Had Martin Baynard and the Stoney family once lived in the area where we stay? Or if it was characteristic of him to rage at fate and express his grief with such abandon, I would surely have the answer to the strange sight of that night. The specter of a man who had been dead for 200 years. Was he accompanied by his once beautiful bride? I shivered. As I opened your book and for the first time read the story, "There Goes Martin Baynard's Carriage," I was chilled to the bone. Every hair on the back of my neck stood up. His carriage is what I must have seen on the beach that night, and I am filled with awe. It's a letter from Shirley Sigmund, September 11th, 1997. If you are at Hilton Head during the latter part of August, stroll the beach at the midnight hour. You may see a black funeral carriage hurtling along near the foaming surf, or feel the wind as it rushes past. And we're going to read one story from Georgia, since we have a little bit of extra time in this hour. This is the Old Harbor Inn, East Factor's Walk, Savannah, Georgia. Russ Mitchell knew a great deal about Savannah, for it was one of the places his wife traveled on business. They'd often stayed there when he was in the military on leave, because they both loved Savannah's beauty and its good restaurants. Mitchell is a tall, distinguished-looking man with graying hair. He has a military bearing, exudes confidence, and gives the impression of being very much in control, and so he is. His talent is solving daily management problems. When he became general manager of the elegant Old Harbor Inn on River Street, the last thing he had any interest in was Savannah's reputation for ghosts. In fact, if the conversation took a turn in that direction, he was usually quick to say, "All nothing but superstition." The Old Harbor Inn was built in 1892 on the bluff overlooking harbor activity. Since so much of Savannah revolves around the water and ships, it is not surprising that the enormous ceiling beams in the suites were salvaged from old sailing ships. If these beams could talk, they could tell tales of storms, hurricanes, mutinies, piracy, and other exciting events at sea. The impressive leaded glass doors of the inn's main entrance face River Street off East Factor's Walk. The wide, dark floorboards, the oriental rugs, the high ceilings, and the late Victorian decor all contribute to the inn's atmosphere of quiet luxury and comfort. Present-day guests enter unaware of what once went on in this place. From the walls echoed the shouts of slaves unloading ships' cargoes, the creak of huge wooden hoists, the clatter of oaken casks of rum striking the planks of the dock. All of this took place amidst the calls of well-dressed factors who had left their offices above the warehouses and come outdoors to buy and sell, mingled with the Gullah and tribal languages of the African Americans. The slaves joked with each other, exchanged news or sang as they unloaded the cargo and carried it into the warehouses along the waterfront. Russ Mitchell had tried to give his wife a picture of what riverside life was once like, both at ground level and along the Factor's Walk. At the top of the bluff, on the level of the city street, the walk was now lined with small shops, a steady stream of curious tourists wandering from one to the other. "In those early days here it was very different," says Mitchell. "From ship to dock to the damp basements of the warehouses, black slaves glistening with sweat hoisted bound boxes of cargo and even bales of cotton from the first floor up through holes in the second floor. Just imagine this river as the lifeblood of Savannah's commerce, and from the early years until the Civil War, cotton as the city's gleaming white flesh. Cotton brought the wealth that built the magnificent homes around our beautiful city squares. That, along with the money of a Civil War blockade runner who used his millions to help rebuild the impoverished city." "When was the Harbor Inn building built?" his wife asked. "Sometime in the 1890s. Like most of the buildings below the bluff, this was built as a warehouse, not an inn. And the part with our suite? The east end, or early part of this building, was built about 1907, before the fire. It was about that time that the legend of a man called Hank began. From the time I came here, I heard the old stories about Hank. Someone mentioned him first at a 1995 sales meeting." "What kind of stories were they?" she asked. "Crazy stuff. He worked here during the early 1900s. They say he was a troublemaker from the beginning. Nothing suited him. The factors provided his living quarters in this building, and he was always complaining about them or the people he worked with." "Did he give any serious trouble?" his wife asked. "Everyone suspected that he was the one who set the old warehouse fire. His anger must have done him in, for he was the only person who died in the fire. Let's forget him. I've never thought it was worth talking about." They both enjoyed exploring the riverside shops, and then they went up to their suite at the inn. His wife, who had just returned from a business trip, was tired and fell asleep almost immediately. Russ sat up reading, was in bed before midnight. He had fallen asleep when he heard his wife calling him. This is how he tells it. "Sound asleep, I dimly heard my wife's voice saying, 'Russ, Russ, wake up.' She shook me. 'Someone is trying to get into our room.' It took a minute or so to penetrate, but I got up, walked sleepily over, and opened the door to the hall. No one was there, and it was 2:30 in the morning. The first thing I thought of was of the stories about Hank, and that made me realize how superstitious we can be without realizing it. The hall was completely empty, so I closed the door and got back in bed." I was almost asleep again when I heard a noise. The handle of the door was turning. This was too much. I went back and opened it again. Nothing. I stationed myself very quietly behind it and stared out through the peephole into the hall. As I stood there, the door handle, only a few inches away from my waist, began to turn. My heart began going a mile a minute. I snatched that door open, ready for whoever, but the hall was empty. "Come in, Hank," I said loudly. Nothing stirred. I stayed awake watching the door handle for quite a while, but that was the last time it turned that night. The next morning, my wife sat on the bed, putting on her pumps, when suddenly she jumped up, face white. "Russ, someone is sitting on this bed with me." I could see no one, but she was sure someone was there. "Is Hank the restless spirit at the Old Harbor Inn?" "No one knows. The guests write surprising notes and leave them for the staff. One guest wrote that he was sitting in a non-smoking room and he sniffed the aroma of a strong cigar, and another guest reported that he returned to his suite to discover his luggage in a most extraordinary place, the bathroom tub. Mr. Mitchell, the perfect example of a courteous, dignified former military man, tries to explain the Old Harbor Inn ghost. It all seems to happen in what we call the East End, but I assure you, Hank is an infrequent visitor. The Old Harbor Inn at 508 East Factors Walk has single rooms and lovely two-bedroom suites overlooking the Savannah River. The suites are ideal for a family vacation. For the chance of an even more memorable trip, you might wish to reserve one of the rooms where the ghost has appeared. For information, phone 912-234-4100. And that is the end of Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Joyner, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. So long, until next time.